It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. What kind of person climbs 3,000 feet without a rope?
I definitely feel fear the same as anybody else when I think I'm actually in danger. The difference is that I'm able to differentiate when I'm truly in danger versus when I'm just having sort of an irrational fear response.
That's Alex Honnold, the guy who stunned the world with his free climb of El Capitan. He's the subject of the new documentary, Free Solo.
No wall is difficult the whole way. And so in the easy parts, I think about anything. You know, I think about the view. I think about when I'm going to eat lunch. The same way, like, when you're out jogging, your mind wanders and you think about your day. When I get to the harder sections, that's where I really focus. And then my mind empties and I just perform. When it's going well, I mean, it definitely feels beautiful. It's awe-inspiring in, like, the actual definition of the word. The grandeur, I mean, it's just a real sense of awe. I mean, I'm willing to wager I spend more time thinking about death than the average person. Just because, you know, I'm in those kinds of situations all the time, and it does happen in the community, you know, from time to time. I don't think I have any particularly profound thoughts about it, just that, you know, an acceptance that everybody's going to die. And so you may as well do your best before then.
Alex Honnold is the world's best free soloist. He's one of my very best friends. But I think that he pretty easily discounts the uncontrollable risks, which is scary to me. I mean, it's a little bit like watching a friend play Russian roulette.
Tommy Caldwell is another top climber. He's the guy who free-climbed the Dawn Wall a couple of years ago, which is an even harder section of El Capitan. Now, Tommy usually climbs with ropes. Alex doesn't, which makes things complicated. Tommy was actually in Yosemite helping Alex prepare in secret for that rope-free solo, and Steve Paulson caught up with him just a few days later. Tommy had clearly been thinking about his own relationship with risk. For himself, he says he's always considered climbing without ropes selfish, reckless, and stupid.
Yeah, I definitely have said that at times. I look at Alex and, you know, it's this funny thing, like, you admire it because people who live life without fear, there's something very appealing about that. But if you take into account the people that love you, it is those things. It's reckless, selfish, and stupid. Yeah, so I just consider that a lot. How far should we take this world of risk? You know, I call Alex kind of like my drug dealer in a way. He's like he's my pusher of risk. He's the guy that takes me out there and convinces me to do stuff that I probably shouldn't be doing. And it's always so fun. That's the problem. We go out into these mountains and I would just come back being like, oh, that was the most amazing experience, but I really shouldn't do that.
Tommy, I want to take a step back and talk about your life as a rock climber, because I know it goes way back. And you write about this in your memoir, The Push. When did you start climbing?
I started climbing when I was 3 years old, actually. My dad was a mountain guide, so it's kind of what we did growing up.
Wow, 3 years old. So are these sort of little walks in the woods or more than that?
No, not really. I mean, the first climb that my parents like to talk about me doing was a thing called the Bowels of the Owls on this rock spire called Twin Owls, which is a few hundred feet tall.
And so by the time you were, say, 6 or 7, what were you doing?
It just progressively got bigger and bigger. We started going to Yosemite every year. We also did a lot of ski touring. It was a very abnormal way to grow up back then. I think everybody looked at my dad with thinking he was a bit of a lunatic, honestly, bringing me and my sister out on these very, very scary-looking adventures.
Yeah, and your dad comes across in your book as this overwhelming presence in your life. I mean, he had been a competitive bodybuilder, then became a mountain guide, and was a skilled rock climber himself. Was he sort of your model of the person you wanted to be?
I mean, I think an overwhelming presence is a pretty good way to put it. Mostly that was a very good thing. I mean, his big skill in life is to, I guess I would say, spread stoke. Like, he gets people excited about things like no other person I've ever met. And I had that every day growing up.
Spread stoke.
Yeah.
I love that phrase.
Yeah, it's almost like surfer bra talk, you know? Yeah, but climbers use it too. So, yeah. And then the other aspect to that is, you know, I sort of spent my life out on the battlefield in a way. Like, you know, he changed my diapers in snow caves. I knew how to, like, crouch in the right way to avoid lightning strikes when I was, like, 7 years old. And so it possibly changed my view on risk, which, you know, could have gotten me in trouble in life.
So you were not the kind of kid who cared much about school or was hanging out with other kids playing school sports?
No, because my childhood environment was so engaging and so utterly exciting that school was kind of boring in comparison. I was also, just a slightly awkward, socially awkward little boy. That probably facilitated my obsession with the outdoors, because when you go outside, you know, you don't have to interact with people the same way you do in school.
Did you ever have a fear of heights?
You know, I remember, I have this very, very vague memory of doing my first rappel when I was like, 4 years old or something, and being scared of that. But that's about it, honestly.
Your first rappel at age four.
yeah. And so I don't really remember being afraid of heights. I think actually I'm shockingly unafraid of heights, which is kind of scary in itself.
Hmm. So even when you were really young, when you were kind of, standing on top of a cliff looking over it, that did not send shivers down your spine?
No, I always found that very exciting. I have this like fascination with the void, being right on the edge of the abyss. It's, I love hanging out at the top of cliffs. It's like my happy place.
Your happy place. So to pick up the story of your becoming a climber, you were really serious in your late teens. I mean, you were a top climber at that point, and you basically trained all the time. And I guess I wonder physically what it takes to become a great climber.
I think that it's good to be quite skinny and sort of lanky. Climbers tend to be the nerds in school. When you bring climbing into like middle school or high school environment, it's the kids that are really bad at basketball and football and those kind of more traditional sports that excel in climbing.
That's interesting. So I guess I would just assume that, to be an athlete, you're usually pretty coordinated, but it sounds like a different kind of athleticism.
Yeah, climbing is it's actually a pretty controlled sport. You're moving relatively slowly. I always have had bad hand-eye coordination. Like, I tried to play baseball when I was young and I was absolutely miserable at it. But climbing is way more about having this adventurous attitude. It's way more about being willing to suffer, I guess.
Were you one of those guys who could do a pull-up with one finger?
I was. I was. But it was funny. When you looked at me, you were like, that guy, he looks like you could break him with your pinky. I mean, I was pretty skinny and small as a kid.
So by the time you were in your early 20s, you were one of the world's top climbers. And you and your girlfriend, another serious climber, Beth Rodden, and two other guys went to Kyrgyzstan. And you were kidnapped by Islamic militants. They held you hostage for 6 days. You were starving. These militants were getting chased around by local army soldiers. Things were pretty desperate. Did you think you were going to die?
Yes, definitely thought I was going to die. This was one of these experiences so intense that when I sat down to write this book, I wrote about it first because it's something that I was almost afraid to go back to and sort of re-experience. I'd sort of blocked it out of my head. Yeah, I definitely thought we were going to die.
So finally, you escaped by pushing a man off a cliff.
Yeah, so we were held hostage for 6 days in the middle of this war. We had to abandon, along with our captors, all of our food, all of our warm clothing. We came across water maybe once a day, these kind of muddy puddles. We were on the verge of hypothermia because we were high in the mountains of Kyrgyzstan, probably 50 miles from the nearest road. The night that we escaped, there was a thunderstorm rolling in. You could smell rain in the air. And I was pretty certain that if we got wet at that point in this environment, we were going to succumb to hypothermia. So I waited until the last possible moment. We were climbing up this big 2,000-foot mountainside with our one remaining captor at this time. The other captors had been sort of picked off by the Kyrgyz military. And high on this mountain, just before about to top out, I made this decision to take matters into our own hands. And I ran up behind this armed rebel, grabbed his gun strap, and pulled him over this ledge. And, he fell out of sight. And then we ran down the valley to the nearest military outpost. And that's how we escaped.
How did you feel about that?
I felt really mixed. I mean, I think a lot of people are like, oh, you did such this heroic thing by you know, pushing this rebel off this cliff, this evil man. But to us, he wasn't evil. You know, he was a victim of circumstance. He was, you know, a 19-year-old hired mercenary. I did what I felt had to be done, but it was really hard for me because I was like, who am I to take somebody else's life? Like, was I an evil person? Over time, however, I did sort of understand, come to grips with that, and even learn to appreciate what that did for me psychologically and how it helped me sort of grow into a man. I call that moment sort of my coming of age moment in a lot of ways.
Really? Because you were forced to make this profound life and death decision?
Yeah, I was forced to make the decision, and it was actually quite empowering because I knew that when things really go badly, I had the capacity to respond. You know, I noticed my night vision improving. I felt almost invincible in a way, and it was the survival instinct kicking in.
So then a year later or so, you had a very different kind of trauma. You were doing some woodworking with a table saw, and you cut off your left index finger.
Right. Yeah, I mean, kind of minor in comparison in some ways.
but for a world-class climber, you don't want to lose an index finger.
Yeah, I think my story, this book, and really my story is a lot of really encountering these hard things and figuring out ways to have them feel you. And I remember sitting in the hospital, the doctor coming in, he was a climber himself, and telling me that I should start thinking about what else I want to do in my life because I wasn't going to be able to climb. And I internalized that, and by the time I left the hospital, I had sort of turned that towards almost anger towards him in a way. I was like, he has no idea what I'm capable of. And so I focused my training in this unbelievable way. It just made me double down, really. It made me step up my game. It also made me change the style of climbing that I did. I was more of a competition climber before that. So I went more in the direction of big wall climbing and adventure climbing, which is what suited me better anyways.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like sort of when you're on a wall, I mean, like a really big wall, I don't know, does the rock feel alive to you at all?
Yeah. You know, on the Don Wall specifically, this, you know, El Capitan is this wall that I've spent 20 years of my life sort of focusing on. Yeah, I speak to it at times. You know, I talk to the holds. I ask the mountain not to kill me. I sort of, we look at these little holds that we're climbing on and, you know, we'll speak to them and be like, please be kind to me today. Don't cut my fingertips. You know?
Okay, so I have to ask you about the Don Wall and Yosemite's El Capitan. I mean, what you're most famous for, which are the climb that you did just over 2 years ago, which is considered the most difficult big wall climb in the world. What makes that so hard?
So the Don Wall was definitely not the first free climb on El Cap. I had done 12 previous routes, but it fascinated me because it's the biggest, steepest part of El Capitan, which in a lot of ways is rock climbing's central big wall. It's the most famous wall in the world. It sits right in, you know, Yosemite National Park, like a mile from the road, and it's where everything goes down in terms of big wall climbing. So I was, you know, lucky enough to be the person that knew more about free climbing on that wall than anybody.
And when you talk about free climbing, you're talking about, I mean, you've got a rope, but there's no other aid to get you up. I mean, it's just all your own power to climb that wall.
Yeah, that's right. A lot of people think when you say free climbing that you mean free soloing, which means if you fall, you die. That's not what I do. You have the ropes there to catch you in case you fall.
So why is the Don Wall so challenging?
Yeah, so it looks impossible. I think most of the other routes on those big walls, you follow crack systems to a trained eye. You can kind of imagine climbing them. The Don Wall, even to me, looking at it from the ground, I was like, that looks blank. It looks like there's no way to climb that. But after having climbed on the wall for 15 years before I started doing the Don Wall, I understood that little holds form and, you know, that you can only see if you get your face a few inches from the wall. And if you train yourself properly and you've had a lifetime of practice, you can learn to climb on them. And trying to link together this maze of climbing moves up a 3,000-foot wall is just this fascinating question. And it really was exactly what I was talking about for it. It's about picking a goal that is above you and then trying to change your life in a way that you can rise to that level.
When you talk about little holds, how big are these holds?
Oh, I mean, you're grabbing onto things that are really just spots of texture, like edges that are the size of the edge of a credit card. Sometimes you're stepping on things that are so small that you can't see them from 4 feet away. You actually have to take a little bit of chalk and mark it. And then you're climbing with these sticky rubber shoes, and you sort of learn to press that rubber into those shoes, and you know, they take off just enough weight. And it's really like a dance or a gymnastics routine to successfully climb this stuff. You have to rehearse the moves over and over and over again until you can do the routine perfectly. And so that was the 7-year process. It was first finding the line, finding the route up the wall.
So you've mapped every foot of this climb before you actually did it.
Yes, I could spend the next 5 hours right now telling you that you walk up to the base of the wall and there's this little tiny U-shaped edge that you put your index finger on the right side of. You take your foot. I mean, I could go on forever. I could still today, 2.5 years later, I could tell you that. It's like learning a language doing a route like this.
So you had a climbing partner, Kevin Jorgensen, and the two of you spent 19 days on the Dawn Wall. And by the end, everyone was watching. I mean, the New York Times, NPR had daily reports, you know, charting your progress or lack thereof. And there was one point where Kevin got stuck in one place for several days, and it looked like he might not make it.
Yeah, he cut his fingers quite badly and then he tried to tape them up. But ultimately, he realized that he just had to wait it out. He had to let his fingertips heal enough, which was a really risky thing because we were up there in the middle of winter. We were up there in January. A storm could come in, and when storms come in, ice fall follows the storms, and you kind of have to get off the wall.
Lucky for you, he made it then.
Yes.
So when you finally got up there, I mean, this thing that you'd have been obsessing about for a decade and actively working at for 7 years, it's sort of like you got the monkey off your back, right?
Yeah, I mean, sort of. It was weird. You would think that that topping out would have been this dream come true, and I guess it was in some ways. I mean, it was something that I doubted for so many years, and then it happened. And in a lot of ways, it was sort of a combination of everything I'd worked for, and it came to be. It actually worked out. But even more forefront in my mind than that was that 7-year process was this magical journey. I mean, it was so unbelievably beautiful to me, and it was ending. It was like a love affair being done, and that was kind of sad.
Right. I mean, you must have felt like, oh my God, what the hell do I do now? I've finally done it.
Yeah, a bit. Yeah, for sure. So it was a weird mixture of relief and sadness, honestly.
Well, as a non-climber, hearing about all of this, it's pretty fascinating, I have to say. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Tommy Caldwell talking with Steve Paulson. His memoir is called The Push, A Climber's Journey of Risk, Endurance, and Going Beyond Limits. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
Hi, my name is Alex Honnold. I'm a professional climber and author of the book Alone on the Wall. And my dangerous idea is sort of a combination of many different adventure elements here, but focusing on climbing. Going into the Karakoram in Pakistan to climb Trango Tower without a rope, so free soloing. So it's like a 5,000-foot granite wall by yourself where you hike in. Well, first you have to cross Pakistan, which has a certain amount of danger there on the Karakoram Highway, just the driving and, you know, the political side of it. And then you get to base camp, and then you have to climb this huge wall, and you have to cross glaciers to get to it, which is quite dangerous by yourself so you don't fall in holes. And then you climb the wall by yourself without a rope, which has never been done and seems completely insane, but it's maybe possible. And you're at 20,000 feet, so you're probably hypoxic and quite lightheaded, which might make the whole dangerous idea seem like a better idea, since you can't really get any oxygen to your brain anyway. And then when you get to the top, you can wingsuit off the top, fly back down to your camp, and then freaking maybe try to like pack raft out or something, you know, just to go down one of the drainages out from the Baltoro Glacier or something. And then you just have the ultimate adventure link-up, where pretty much any aspect of the adventure could potentially kill you. Yeah, I think that's the most adventure I can pack into one. I think that's all I got. So funny enough, I kind of think somebody probably will do this within the next 50 years. I mean, yes, I think this is possible and probably will be done eventually. You know, all the different aspects of it have sort of been done to some extent. It just seems completely outrageous, though.
And that dangerous idea comes from Alex Honnold, who just made the historic first ascent of Yosemite's El Capitan without a rope. You can listen to our interview with Alex on our website at ttbook.org. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. There's a mental state that elite athletes know well. Those moments when you're performing at the peak of your ability and everything clicks. Your inner narrator goes silent. You feel completely immersed and absorbed in what you're doing. Time disappears. Those are called flow states. And you've probably had them, but maybe not for a while.
The funny thing is about those experiences is that for most of us, they happen accidentally, they happen occasionally. They might have happened a lot when we were children or a lot when we were athletes playing team sports, but as our lives change and get more complicated, they either just diminish in our lives or we just kind of fly blind looking for them, you know, the sort of nearest the last place we found one.
Jamie Wheel is an expert on peak performance. He's helped everyone from Navy SEALs to NFL, NBA, and Major League athletes achieve flow states. And he says neuroscientists have finally figured out how to hack the brain so any of us can do it.
We can do a literal end run around our waking conscious selves. You don't have to use your waking conscious self to try and get rid of it. It doesn't work. It's like trying to hide your own Easter eggs, you know. But what you can do is you can say, hey, I'm going to calibrate my breathing, my brain waves, my heart rate, my posture, and a host of other neurophysiological factors. And that's what we're saying is game changing.
So the psychologist who, as far as I know, first began writing about flow is Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. And since then, it's been studied a lot. What would surprise people to know about it today?
That's a great question. I mean, I think one of the things that's exciting is that it's no longer just a psychological study. So when Csikszentmihalyi first started, I mean, there wasn't real-time brain scanning. There wasn't the ability to check neurotransmitters in a system. There wasn't the ability to see what was happening under the hood. So all he had really had to go on was psychological subjective self-reporting. And they literally had little pagers, you know, buzzing in people's pockets. So someone would maybe be in a flow state where they were losing track of themselves and then bzzz, and then, you know, the little text thing would be like, on a scale of 1 to 5, how flowy do you feel right now? Which obviously right, kind of defeats the point. You're like, well, I was there. Now I'm not. Thanks. Now, how do I get back?
Can you actually break this flow state down in terms of specific biochemicals, neurochemicals that need to come online?
Sure. Yeah. You know, we can first start with what it isn't. And what it isn't is 21st century normal, that tired, wired, stressed experience. And what that looks like as far as the neurobiology, if we're talking right now, anybody listening, we're probably in a beta brainwave state. That's a relatively fast brainwave state. It is particularly, you know, it's correlated with activity in the prefrontal cortex, which is the front part, the complex part of our brain that houses most of our sense of self, our sense of executive function, delayed gratification, long-term decision-making, abstract planning, all that kind of stuff. So that stuff's up and running at full speed, humming along with beta waves. And the tired, wired, and stressed part, you know, we're not dodging saber-toothed tigers these days, right? So our stress response, which is a lot of norepinephrine and cortisol, right? Those are super helpful for sudden, sharp, fight or flight, moments. Mm-hmm. But they're terrible for us to just have them on 24/7. There we are in traffic, rehashing a conversation we wish we had with our boss. I have phantom phone buzzing in my pocket. Ooh, was that a new update? What was that? Mm-hmm. Right? Those kind of moments eat us alive. So that's normal.
And these, that sounds these, horrible.
Isn't it? You're like, how do we do anything? So then you say, you realize, okay, so ecstasis, these states that take us outside ourselves, that's just the old ancient Greek literal definition of it. That signature shifts in every single way. So our brain waves tend to slow down from beta to alpha and even theta. And those are much slower, more contemplative, relaxed, almost sometimes even dreamy or hypnagogic states, those kind of states in between waking and sleeping. Our brain activity, the network that basically supports and creates our sense of self-awareness, some of those nodes power down, and as a result, that inner critic and the self-awareness tends to go offline. The stress chemicals get flooded out. So nitric oxide quits a neurotransmitter and it kind of pushes through our system and flushes out those stress chemicals, and in come dopamine, endorphins, and anandamide.
These are all the pleasure chemicals that the body can produce. So is the shorthand version of everything you're saying just do stuff that makes you feel good? Because on the other hand, if I did that, I might just sit around at home with giant cartons of ice cream.
Yeah, well, I would say, you know, it's in some respects, it's sort of like hashtag do the obvious. Sleep more, move often, eat well, be grateful, get outside. I mean, none of this stuff is mysterious. It's just, do we give ourselves permission in the pell-mell of the day-to-day to actually say, no, this stuff matters.
I know I should do all of those things. We all know we should do all those things. Honestly, pick up a, you know, People magazine or Redbook or something, and they all tell us we should do all of those things, and a lot of us try.
You know, A, this stuff sounds so obvious that we can just kind of forget it and not do it, and B, how would we give ourselves permission to what might otherwise seem self-indulgent? I actually shouldn't be working 70-hour weeks and bragging about them. I should go home after 50, because that's what all the research shows is the massive drop-off in performance. I shouldn't tell myself I'm too busy to have a full breakfast or take a shower standing up. I should take a long, hot bath. I shouldn't ignore my primary relationships and my spouse and my children. If I take the time, the performance gains from doing these things are anywhere from 200% to 490%.
So part of what you're prescribing here is common sense, and you know, you make a great point that we know what we should do, we just don't do it. But you should tell the story. There's a story you tell in the book about how Navy SEALs are using, basically are figuring out how to deliberately induce this flow state in order to get small teams to develop this kind of hive mind. Tell us what the SEALs are doing.
Well, we were privileged enough to have the chance to observe DevGroup, or what is sort of commonly known as SEAL Team 6. Got to spend some time with them and see how they learn and operate. And beyond all of the, you know, heroic physical and tactical things that they train for, the key thing that their commanders are looking for is, can one of their SEALs, with chaotic conditions all around them, which direction does he go? Does he merge with his teammates, and do they create a shared real-time decision-making and action collective? Flipping the switch is what their commander called it.
What does that even mean?
The technical term that the SEALs use is dynamic subordination. And what it means is, regardless of rank and regardless of whatever they planned before they actually dropped out of the helicopter to go on the mission, whoever knows what to do next is in charge. They take the lead. So they're offloading elements that would have been a rational, separate individual would have to handle all by themselves. And they're trusting each other. And that trust isn't just awarded, it's earned. It's earned every single day.
I guess I'm not entirely sure what you mean. They're not stopping to say, okay, who thinks we should go right and who thinks we should go left?
Well, no, I mean, that stuff's out the window. Yeah, it's not different than, you know, Steph Curry and the Golden State Warriors, right? I mean, or any amazing sports team, or even what the Patriots did in the Super Bowl. Right. And we clearly know it when we see it, right? You know, and we pay dearly to be in the presence of it. And that experience, by the way, is, you know, for any of us to get to experience. And it can be as simple as singing in a church choir together. It could be line dancing on a Saturday night, you know, here in Austin at the Broken Spoke. Right. It could be any of these moments where we just set aside our fragmented sense of ourselves and we do something greater together. That's usually pretty intoxicating.
You also talk about people who are experimenting with more active ways of hacking our way to these high-performance states. For instance, you quote Tim Ferriss in your book saying something extraordinary. He says, the billionaires I know, almost without exception, use hallucinogens on a regular basis. So it sounds like there actually are some chemical cocktails that can also help us get to this state you're talking about.
Yeah, for sure. Off-label, this is exactly what is happening in Silicon Valley. And, you know, we talk about the Music and Arts Festival of Burning Man as an example, which, you know, the coverage of that event is almost always salacious. You know, it's sort of, oh, naked hippies doing drugs in the desert. Or it's kind of celebrity hounding, oh, look, there's Katy Perry or P. Diddy on a Segway. You know, but no one's actually asking the question, why does Silicon Valley basically shut down? I mean, there's articles in the San Francisco Chronicle about now this is the week you can actually get a reservation at that restaurant you've been always trying to get into because the place is just a ghost town. And the question is why? And what is happening is that, yeah, these Silicon Valley leaders and executives are absolutely using non-ordinary states of consciousness to innovate faster and to come back and seed their businesses and their next technological developments and breakthroughs.
Wow. So if I want to come up with the next great public radio show, if I dropped some microdoses of acid, would I get there?
Well, I mean, James Vadiman, who did research at Hewlett-Packard and Stanford back in the 60s before the research was shut down and has now revived that, the answer from those studies would be quite possibly. He did studies with a ton of Silicon Valley engineers. The criteria for being part of the study was you had to have been working on a hard technical problem for at least 6 months and having no success solving it. And when they did, and they did sub-perceptual doses of, I believe it was LSD and mescaline, those guys had something like 10 to 12 meaningful breakthroughs, meaning patentable, meaning deployable and fundable, you know, breakthroughs in their work and insights. And that's part of what we're talking about with this revolution. You know, meditation used to be the domain solely of kind of seekers and saints. And flow states were sort of artists and athletes. And psychedelics were hippies and ravers. And none of those communities of practice would recognize each other, would talk to each other, would acknowledge they were doing similar or the same things. And what we see once we take a look at the neurobiology is we're like, oh, let's just move into cognitive literacy. Let's take responsibility for our decisions and our choices in this domain. And let's be a lot more skillful, a lot healthier, and a lot more productive with what we all choose to do together.
Jamie, thanks.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
Jamie Wheel is the author with Steve Kotler of Stealing Fire: How Silicon Valley, the Navy SEALs, and Maverick Scientists are revolutionizing the way we live and work. Maybe one reason it took so long to figure out how to do something athletes know is that old stereotype of the athlete as dumb jock, which is not just insulting, it's also wrong, literally. Neuroscientist John Krakauer can prove it. He studies skilled athletes, and he says what sets them apart isn't just physical, it's cognitive condition. Here's John talking with Steve Paulson.
When you admire an athlete, where should the credit go? You know, Michael Jordan, does he jump higher? Does he have a shorter reaction time? Does he throw further? No. I mean, if you were to compare those low-level abilities with 20 other basketball players of his generation, he probably wouldn't stand out. So you have to sort of go up a notch to explain what it is that made him so much better over and over again.
So it's not just sheer athleticism.
No,
it's something else.
It's something else. In other words, this ability to, in clutch play, make the right decision and execute that decision simultaneously.
So it sounds like what you're saying is we're really talking about the brains of athletes. I mean, this is not generally what one tends to think about when it comes to, you know, what sets the star athlete apart,
yes,
from everyone else.
Yes, I mean, people will, you know, maybe, oh, they have bigger muscles, you know, or they're just very tall if they're a basketball player, that it's something physical. But no, I think one has to give just as much credit to the nervous system of an athlete as one would to a mathematician or a musician.
So what's happening in their brains?
Well, I mean, making the right decisions and being tactical during a match is probably not that different from any other cognitive activity, you know, writing a poem or working out how you're going to arrange your troops on the battlefield. All right. So there, it'll probably end up being in prefrontal cortex like anything else. When it comes to precision, in other words, how can it be that somebody like Roger Federer can hit the ball faster than us and get it in more often? Well, that is probably going to be more about motor cortical areas. I mean, they've done that work on musicians, for example. There seems to be expansion, if I may say, of representation of fingers in good pianists.
Are we talking about the old 10,000 hours of practice kind of thing?
Yes.
The more you do it, there's that old phrase, muscle memory.
Well, muscle memory is one of those terms, a little bit like nervous breakdown, that doesn't really mean much to scientists. But I think what muscle memory means is this idea of a control policy, like an intelligent reflex. What do I mean by that? I mean that you've practiced and practiced until, for example, your ATM code, or even when you type. In other words, I'm not sure if I were to ask you right now, write out all the letters of the keys of your keyboard. You're probably not going to be able to do it.
No, I wouldn't be able to do that.
But your fingers know where the letters are.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So in other words, I think what people mean by muscle memory is that through practice, which originally did require very explicit looking down at the keys, seeing where the A is, and then you keep doing that until eventually it seems as though even though you can no longer declaratively state where the letters are on the keyboard, you seem to now know when you put your hands down on it. I do this all the time. I don't know my ATM number, but my finger does. Now imagine, instead of just practicing your ATM code, which is relatively simple in terms of the finger movements you need to make, you had to practice a much more elaborate kind of action, like a serve, for example, or a free throw. And that, too, can automatize the way your ATM number does. Then you can imagine athletes who've been practicing for 10,000 hours establishing a repertoire of stored subroutines that have been automatized. And then what you can do is you can devote your actual expensive thought time to what you're going to do with those building blocks that you have now well established. Whereas for amateurs, we're spending too much time still working on the building blocks.
Hmm. There's that split second of, what should we do now? Whereas you're saying with the professional athlete, they know.
I mean, you can go, and again, I can give the example. You could go up to your ATM machine and you could type in your PIN number and also be talking to me.
Right.
All right? Whereas if you don't know your PIN number, you are not going to be able to devote any cognitive space to anything else other than trying to think about what it is. So I think what makes athletes so good is that they can clear up cognitive space to make much higher level decisions down on building blocks that have been well and truly stored and cached.
Now, there's that old phrase, time slows down for certain people. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Not really. I mean, I think I'll give you an example of why people might think that. I mean, in tennis, good tennis players will predict where the server is serving the ball just by the trunk rotation of the server before the ball anywhere near leaves the racket of the server. Okay, now, if you're an amateur tennis player, you're basically going to start responding when the ball is close to leaving or having left the server's racket. If you think that the reaction time is after the ball has left the racket, you'll come under the impression that the professional tennis player has had so much more time to react. Well, that's an illusion because their reaction time should be time stamped to when they started to see the trunk rotate.
Hmm.
Do you see? So, yeah. In other words, they've had a genuinely longer time.
Now, you're a tennis player
yes,
yourself.
Yes, I used
right?
to be. I used to play a lot. I play more squash now.
So, does all this knowledge of how the brain works, especially in the minds of athletes, is that useful at all for you as an athlete?
No, I don't think it's useful for me to make me any better, unfortunately. It does make me realize more what's going on when I'm getting trained, for example. This interplay between instruction and learning is very interesting to me. So, you know, the notorious thing in squash, for example, is you hate it when the ball goes and hits off the back wall and you're pinned against the back wall
right.
and you start scraping and flailing about trying to get the ball out of the corner. And then you can have a professional squash coach tell you, you know, take your time, turn around completely, don't follow the ball all the way to the back wall, let it go and wait for it to come back. And it's amazing how just a few sentences like that can lead to a qualitative jump in the quality of your performance. So it's this interplay between whatever needs to happen to your nervous system when it keeps practicing something and these little leaps of realization that give you a much bigger jump than you would ever obtain if you kept practicing doing it the wrong way.
Well, what you're talking about is the virtues of a great teacher or a great coach. I mean, they really can transform how well
right.
you can
it's just
do
that
this
I
thing.
Think that a lot of people, because they think there's something low-level, mindless, non-cognitive, motor, implicit about being good at sport, that they tend to downplay how much instruction matters to the same degree that it does when you get told the rules of grammar in your Latin class. So in other words, I think there's a bias. I mean, hence this article we wrote where we said, is the dumb jock really a nerd? Why do we have the term dumb jock? What is the implication? It is that you can be very, very good at sport and be dumb. Right?
Mm-hmm.
You'd never say you could be really, really good at math and be dumb, although we would say that you could be a nerd and be rubbish at sport.
Right.
And that dichotomy is actually not justified, in my view.
That's John Krakauer. He's a neuroscientist at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, and he was talking with Steve Paulson. So there's running, like maybe you like to go for a jog every now and then. And then there's the self-transcendence race, which is running a half-mile loop, the same loop, for 3,100 miles. Try that one. Coming up, the story of the ultimate endurance race. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. People exercise and play sports for lots of different reasons. To compete, to get in shape, and also sometimes for personal inner growth. In the mid-1960s, an Indian guru named Sri Chinmoy came to the U.S. to teach meditation. Now, Chinmoy was a runner and a weightlifter, and he believed physical endurance could also be a path to enlightenment. So he founded this famously grueling Sri Chinmoy Self-Transcendence 3,100-mile race. And it still goes on. It takes place every year in Queens around a single half-mile loop. So I just want to pause here to let the sheer incomprehensibility of this wash over us. This is a race where you run the same half-mile 6,200 times in a row. Shuprabha Bekjer did this not just once, but 13 straight years. Her personal record is 63 miles a day for 49 days and 14 hours. Raymond Tungekar was kind of staggered.
So I got to be honest with you. When I first heard about this race, I was simply blown away. Like, I'd never heard of anything like that before. And I guess the obvious question is, why would anyone want to run 3,000 miles around a city block?
I love running, and I discovered it's like a pilgrimage when you just keep running like that. And when you have your own schedule, you don't have to go to work. You don't have to check in with, you know, faxes and phone calls and all this kind of thing. And there's a real freedom in it. And it's a way to make spiritual progress also. That's what I've discovered.
Wow. Let's just put this in perspective. This is an amazing feat of endurance. I mean, it's basically the equivalent of running from Boston to L.A. What is it like to run that distance? Doesn't it take an incredible physical toll on your body?
Well, I'm very lucky. You know, all the years that I ran the race, 13 years in a row, I haven't had a sustained injury from it. I think it does take a toll in the end, but I would never say, oh, it's such a shame I did that, you know, because I got so much out of it. I really did. And the benefits and the inspiration are something I draw on, you know, in my daily life and my work and so forth.
Just to describe this race, it's a half-mile concrete loop over and over again every day for 18 hours. I mean, I imagine that would get kind of boring. How do you break through that tedium?
Yes. If you only focus on the details of the race, the course itself, the concrete sidewalk, it is just over half a mile. If you can get yourself in the right space, and if you do try to enter into a kind of a moving meditation in your heart, then you don't feel the details of the course as much. Mm-hmm. So if you take it a step at a time, an hour at a time, a day at a time, then it becomes manageable.
I'm wondering if this run, if it differs in any way as a meditative practice. Because I would imagine that someone listening to this would just say, why put yourself through, you know, this amazing feat of endurance? Like, why not just meditate at home?
It's a matter of inner and outer. Self-transcendence we can experience not just through sports and running, but in every aspect of our existence. But it becomes especially clear if you look at it in terms of running, walking, swimming, because the idea is that today I'm running 1 mile. But then the next day you try to do more. And to go beyond your limits, that offers you a satisfaction that nobody can take away from you.
What do you think about while you're running, you know, an incredibly long race like this?
I really tried to focus a bit inward on qualities that I wanted to bring forward, pulling forward sweetness, enthusiasm, joy, these kind of qualities, imagining that I was in a garden, like a child in a garden playing. I found that if I could focus on my heart in this way, then the mileage would go much faster. In other words, if every lap I come around and I'm just like, okay, that's another half a mile, it's like, oh, it's discouraging. But if you're just focusing on the flow and you come around and you see your whoever's supporting you, your helper at that time, you know, you exchange a few words and you see the other runners and you just encourage each other, you know, then it's a joyful experience.
But as a lot of runners know also, there's at some point, you know, you hit the wall, your body just can't take it anymore, and your mind just kind of shuts down, and you have no will to continue running. What do you do to push through that, or do you even get to that point?
Oh, yes, I would say quite a few times. And that's where I would try to pull the meditation in, and this idea of the running in the garden, and the idea of running and feeling I was a small child. You know, so it's a very nice idea because then you don't feel your actual age. You know, you kind of go beyond that and you imagine just, you know, if you think of a child is all kind of innocence and purity and joy, really. But since we all have a whole bouquet of beautiful qualities inside us that we can pull forward, then, you know, this is something that can work even for an older person.
For people who aren't spiritually inclined, I mean, what can they take away from your experience? I mean, are there things we all can do to make running more meditative or self-transcendent?
Well, I would say yes, definitely. I think everybody, many people who are involved in sports would feel a difference between, you know, when you're just experiencing the joy of your running or swimming or hiking, and when you're focusing only on the mental aspect of, you know, how hot it is and how tired you are and this kind of thing. I mean, anybody that's done a marathon, I think, has had to pull forward something from inside. And also the inspiration and encouragement of our teacher who, as the years went on, he became more and more kind of involved in the race. In the beginning, he would stop by once in a while, and then by the end, he was visiting us at least three times a day if he was in town. And the last 2 years, he was writing like a kind of a poem or prayer for each day, and it would be posted. Mm. And I've actually brought it, if you'd at some point like to hear a couple of them.
Oh, sure. That'd be great.
Okay. So these were prayers that that Sri Chinmoy wrote with the runners in mind, and these were written in 2006. And this is from the beginning of the collection. I run the world's longest race to dine with God's boundless grace. And then there's another from the last day of that race. Today's victory we celebrate only to invoke a new goal.
Wow, that's really lovely. And so are you thinking about this as you're running? Like, are these mantras for you?
You know, they really are, definitely. And the first one about I run the world's longest race to dine with God's boundless grace. I think I mentioned before that I never felt I was doing that race alone. I really had so much support, not only from my friends that were helping me, but also from above, I have to say. There's absolutely no way. I mean, you are not here with me. You cannot see. I'm quite a small person. And physically, you know, I'm quite slight. And the reason I've been able to complete these long distances is really through my prayer and meditation and through God's grace. And the other one at the end, which was my last day of running that year, today's victory we celebrate only to invoke a new goal. For me, that's very inspiring because I think you were asking, like, at the end of the race, you feel sad if it's over. And actually, this is that notion that, yes, the race is over, but that means I'm looking for my next challenge, wherever I'm going to find it, you know, I'm going to invoke a new goal. And that's, to me, that's part of my spiritual life. It's part of life for any of us. You know, you reach the end of something. You can say that's your, you know, you've completed your distance. That's fine. But you don't want to think of a finish. I'm finished. No, I don't want to feel I'm finished. I don't want to feel I've retired. I want to feel like, no, I see a new goal. I see another mountaintop I want to get to.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me. It's been such a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you so much.
Shuprabha Bechtjard has run the Sri Chinmoy Self-Transcendence 3,100-mile race for 13 years in a row. The annual race takes place around a half-mile loop in Queens, New York, and her personal record is 63 miles a day for 49 days and 14 hours. Raymond Tungekar talked with her. And that's it for our show today, but there's always more in our podcast feed. To sign up, just visit iTunes or Stitcher, or check out our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Steve Paulson, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tungekar, Doug Gordon, and Mark Rickers. Joe Hartke is our technical director, and today's engineer is Steve Gotcher. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Until next time.